Welcome back to the program. Perhaps more than at any other time in the history of the world,
democracy is on the march.
But the idea that people, individual citizens, could engage in the practice of self-government wasn't always so. In fact, it was only with the creation of our Constitution, launched 225 years ago, that the idea was even appropriately articulated. But that Constitution, as brilliant and profound and clever as it was not the be-all and end-all of democracy. It was a starting point from which we would develop laws, establish precedent, and nourish institutions which would provide the foundations of self-government. Those things have grown up to become what our guest Akhil Amar calls the unwritten Constitution. Akhil Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He's a summa cum laude graduate of Yale and a graduate of Yale Law School, where he was editor of the Law Journal. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer when he was a judge on the First Circuit Court of Appeals. His work has been cited in over 20 Supreme Court cases. He was a consultant to the television show The West Wing and the author of 5 previous books. It is my honor to have Akhil Reed Amar here to talk about his new work, America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. Akhil Amar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. And just one other thing, the very kind introduction. I'm a Northern Californian. I grew up in Walnut Creek.
That makes it all better right there.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's interesting, and I think people sometimes forget that so many of the things that we take for granted today, like one person, one vote, desegregation, separation of powers, rule of law, that these are things that are not specifically spelled out in the Constitution.
Not in so many words. Even the phrase, the Bill of Rights, it doesn't appear in the document itself. Proof beyond reasonable doubt. The right of a criminal defendant to take the stand in his own behalf isn't mentioned in the Constitution. And not only that, actually at the time the Constitution was established, no criminal defendant had such a right in any court in America, state or federal. And even when the 14th Amendment came along, long after the Civil War, most jurisdictions didn't respect that right. Today, it's universal, it's bedrock, as is one person, one vote, and all sorts of things that didn't come along until a little bit later in our constitutional experience. But they're all part of, as I said, the bedrock today, today's unwritten Constitution that supplements and supports, strengthens, nurtures, actually, the written Constitution. And, of course, we wouldn't want to lose all the virtues of a written Constitution, even if, as we sometimes have to go between the lines and beneath and beyond the written words. We want to hold up those written words as well.
And much of this stems from the idea that we also sometimes lose sight of, that 225 years ago when we were debating this document, that the whole fundamental idea of self-government was a new idea, that there weren't pre-established institutions and ideas with which to design this.
I believe that 225 years ago, is the hinge of all of world history. Before the Constitution was put to a vote across the continent, which began in September 1787, so 225 years ago, basically this month, before that, the history of the world, very few democracies on the planet. They exist over tiny little city-states, Athens, pre-imperial Rome, Florence, where people speak the same language and have the same climate and worship the same gods. And then these democracies typically blinked out. They weren't able to defend themselves militarily. So a few democracies for the previous millennia in the history of the planet, you look around the world and say 1786, well, there's some self-governance in England. They've got a House of Commons. They've got a jury system, but they've also got a very powerful monarch and a House of Lords. A little self-government in Switzerland, but they're just a bunch of sheep and goat herders at the time. No Swiss banks for Mitt Romney or anyone else there. So very little democracy in 1786 across the world. Then we, the people of the United States, in 1787, put the thing to a vote. Up and down the continent, it's an extraordinarily inclusive vote. Property qualifications are reduced or eliminated in 8 of the 13 states. It's free speech up and down the continent for a year, people saying audacious things, either pro or con, burnings in effigy, you know, really intense, raucous, American, robust, free speech. No one gets killed in the whole year. It's not like the French Revolution. It's an extraordinary embodiment of democracy, and the world will never be the same and isn't. And now democracy reigns over half the planet, and I believe it's because of this audacious experiment that really begins in 1787.
And it's interesting that in the debate about the document itself, there were many people that were opposed to it, people like James Monroe and Patrick Henry and others. And out of that grew things that we now take for granted, like the very Bill of Rights itself.
Exactly. The Bill of Rights, which is, and those words actually don't appear in the document, but that's what we call the first 10 amendments. The phrase that does appear the most often in those amendments is the phrase "the people," the right of the people to assemble in the First Amendment, and the people have a right to keep and bear arms in the Second, and the words "the people" appear in the Fourth and the Ninth and the Tenth, and that's not a coincidence because those amendments came from the people. The First Amendment talks about the freedom of speech, and that's because it came out of an extraordinary exercise of the freedom of speech by the people themselves in this year-long process. So even before we said the freedom of speech in the text, we the people did freedom of speech in adopting the Constitution, and it is extraordinary that people who in effect lost the vote on the Constitution, the so-called anti-federalists, well, they won the next round. They got a Bill of Rights, and so it's a great American tradition in which dissenters are part of it. People who lose today can be part of the process tomorrow. People who voted against the Constitution, like James Monroe, become presidents of the President of the United States, and vice presidents George Clinton and Elbridge Gerry, justices on the Supreme Court, Samuel Chase. It's an extraordinary exhibit to the rest of the world about majority rule, but also the rights of dissenters who are respected and taken seriously. One other way of putting it is the Constitution 1.0, this version that was floated 225 years ago, the one crafted at Philadelphia, is crowdsourced. And that crowdsourcing is the ratification process, and it quickly leads to 2.0, which is the Bill of Rights. And that version itself is not perfect. It's more perfect than what went before, but it's not completely perfect. And so we have later amendments, making of amends after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, extensions of women's suffrage in the 20th century, the 19th Amendment in my lifetime, letting 18-year-olds vote, and ensuring that people who can't pay poll taxes are nevertheless allowed to vote. So the story, the saga continues, but it begins 225 years ago with this extraordinary outpouring of democratic energy up and down the continent.
And part of the underlying principle was the idea that one side could win while keeping the losers on board, essentially.
And look around the world today and you see how hard that is in all sorts of places. Who knows whether Iraq will actually succeed in doing that, or Egypt, or so. And it is extraordinary. It's majority rule in each and every state that ratifies the Constitution. Simple majorities prevail, which is relevant for filibuster reform and other stuff today. But the minority is allowed to speak its piece there. Respected, they feel they've been heard, and they therefore acquiesce in it. They buy into the thing, and the Federalists who win are wise enough to actually try to get the losers exactly right, on board. You know, you might win the next election. Maybe we're right. Maybe we made some mistakes in 1.0. Tell us what mistakes we made, and we can, in effect, repeal and replace. We can make this system better than our first version.
Along with this unwritten constitution is this idea that you talk about of an implicit constitution. Explain that.
Well, the Constitution doesn't say in so many words limited government, but that's an idea kind of in the whole thing. It doesn't say checks and balances. It doesn't say in so many words judicial review, separation of powers. It doesn't say federalism. Originally, it didn't say free speech. I already gave you one argument before the Bill of Rights came along. I gave you one argument already for free speech, which is it's how we actually adopted the Constitution. We adopted it through free speech. Here's a second argument. You just look at the Constitution as a whole, and you basically say, what are its premises and presuppositions? Its basic structure is free elections. Now, you can't have free elections if the government can shut down opposition speakers. Its basic if the incumbents can shut down the challengers. Its basic premise is popular sovereignty. It says, we the people do ordain the Constitution. It, in effect, says the government officials are our agents, our servants. They work for us. Well, if that's true, they can't shut us up, you know, any more than your butler can prevent you from speaking at your own dinner table. So even if it doesn't say the people have a right to free speech before the First Amendment comes along, that's implicit in the whole thing when we read between the lines in the same way that principles like limited government, rule of law, separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism are part of the system when you read it as a whole. And you have to read it as a whole because it's actually not that long. It doesn't say all that it means. We have to sort of, as I said, read it holistically and capture its spirit as well as its letter. And the spirit is unwritten.
Even the idea of majority rule was a background principle and not something that was specifically specified.
It's really interesting. The Constitution says 9 states are going to have to say yes, otherwise this thing won't go into effect, and it'll go into effect only among the states that say yes. Great. But what's the rule for each state? By what vote does Virginia join the Constitution, or Massachusetts, or New York? And the document doesn't say. And yet in state after state after state, it's just understood as a background principle that, of course, it's majority rule. The New York Convention that ratifies it votes for the Constitution by a vote of 30-27. So a really close vote, a squeaker. But majority rule was a basic background premise of the system and still is in the following sense. Nothing in the Constitution says that 5 justices always beat 4 if it's in a 9-justice court, and yet that's obvious. It goes without saying that 5 have always trumped the 4, but the document doesn't say so in so many words.
Given all of that, how do we have this originalist argument today, people talking about simply abiding by the letter of the Constitution, the written Constitution?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of folks say that, but in truth, even my good friends on the conservative side of the aisle, on the court and elsewhere, don't do that. They believe in unwritten principles like limited government, like federalism, like the rule of law. So one thing that I'm actually trying to do in this book is to say liberals and conservatives, in fact, have much more in common than you might think if you just hear the sound bites in the culture war. We are all textualists. We are all, to some extent, living constitutionalists. Every single justice on the Supreme Court, my friends Clarence Thomas and Nino Scalia, you know, as well as Steve Breyer, for whom I clerked, all agree, for example, that of course a criminal defendant has a right to take the stand in his own behalf. Even though the text doesn't say that at all, and no criminal defendant in 1789, when the Constitution was adopted, had such an ability to take the stand in his own defense. But now everyone acknowledges that's something that exists today as part of our actual practices that have changed over the course of 200 years.
Because part of it is what you talk about, a kind of lived constitution, which is a very conservative, very Burkean kind of idea.
The chapter that I have on America's lived constitution is all about Burke. The text says that there are unenumerated rights. The Ninth Amendment says that not all the rights of the people are enumerated, are textually listed, are specified. So then the 14th Amendment says states can't interfere with fundamental freedoms, privileges, and immunities of Americans. But the text doesn't say where we find these unenumerated Ninth Amendment rights, where we find these fundamental privileges and immunities that states can't abridge. And one thought is, here's where we find these things. If we find rights of the people by looking at how the people actually live. Not judges looking to them in their own guts or to what judges have said before, looking to what the people have done. The rights and privileges and immunities of citizens include at their core what citizens actually do, how we live our lives. So the Constitution doesn't say in so many words, you have a right to wear a hat or play the fiddle or have a pet dog or to rock on your porch, to enjoy family life with your loved ones, to enjoy consensual conjugal relations with your spouse. But this is America. We've always had these rights in our lived experience, even without the Second Amendment. I would say Americans have always had a right to have a gun in their homes for self-protection. So this isn't always just a sort of a liberal thing. Conservatives, as well as liberals, believe in Burkean traditional customary rights.
The other side of that, though, are the periods of time, and they have been many, where the doctrine, the underlying ideas of the Constitution are out of sync with the document itself.
Yes. And I think that was especially true in the years before Earl Warren came to the Supreme Court. And, of course, he was a three-term governor of California, just right down the road from Napa. And here's what the world looked like in 1952, let's say, right before Warren joined the court. Jim Crow reigned over much of America, apartheid, racial segregation, that was highly unequal, even though the Constitution said equal. Massive deprivations of the right to vote, even though the Constitution, and especially of black people, even though the Constitution had promised in the 15th Amendment that there wouldn't be racial disfranchisement. Huge malapportionment where rural counties got way more clout than large cities, even though the Constitution sort of promised democracy and Republican government. The Bill of Rights actually hadn't been consistently applied against states, only the federal government, even though the 14th Amendment was designed to apply the Bill of Rights against states. Free speech actually had been suppressed in a whole bunch of places, even though the document does say free speech. Criminal defendants had very few constitutional rights, even though the document provides for a lot of their constitutional rights. Organized prayer in the schools, even though the Constitution says that there's supposed to be religious liberty and equality. So that's the world in 1952. The cases, the doctrine, had drifted away from the core commitments of the document itself. And over the course of 16 years on the court, Earl Warren and his colleagues actually brought the doctrine, the Supreme Court rulings, into closer alignment with what the text says, which is equality and Republican government and the rights to vote and free speech and free exercise of religion and no states violating fundamental rights. And today, here's the stunning thing, conservatives as well as liberals, even though the Warren Court seemed to be very controversial at the time, in fact today, conservatives as well as liberals basically all pledge allegiance to the Warren Court. Conservatives say, we believe in one person, one vote, but that means Bush versus Gore. The Florida recount was uneven. We believe in Brown versus Board of Education, but that means actually no affirmative action. It means the Constitution is colorblind. We believe in free speech, but that means also the right to make campaign, to run campaign ads. That's Citizens United. We believe the Bill of Rights applies against the states, but that includes the Second Amendment as well as the other amendments. So what's interesting is actually the Warren Court Revolution, which was so controversial at the time, has actually now provided largely common ground for liberals and conservatives on many, many issues. There's one issue where liberals and conservatives still disagree, and in fact on that one, I'm with the conservatives. I think the Warren Court did go too far in creating and extending an exclusionary rule that lets guilty criminals go free, even though there's very reliable physical evidence of their guilt. And I don't think you can get that from the written Constitution or the unwritten Constitution properly applied, And on that one, I'm actually more with the conservatives than the liberals.
It does seem that the Warren Court provided, that period of time, provided a kind of reset, a kind of Constitution 3.0 that was a jumping-off point for all the issues that we're debating today.
Exactly. And a kind of reset, to go back to what you said at the very beginning, that has provided a really stunning model for the rest of the world, a reset in which we say we're going to allow robust free speech, and we're going to commit ourselves to holding fair elections where there really is a right to vote and one person, one vote, where we're going to ideally have religious equality, not suppression of religion, but religious equality. So the government shouldn't be in the prayer writing business, but ordinary people should be allowed, you know, on their own to pray in schools, either, you know, individually or in Bible studies and other things, but they're not government organized. And that's a model for the rest of the world.
Talk a little bit about the 19th Amendment, how that ties into all of this when we look back and realize that a significant portion of the population had no say in the creation of where we are.
And the 19th Amendment is, I would say there are three especially audacious moments of American history. There's the founding that we've been talking about 225 years ago, this sort of big bang of democratic energy that created amazing momentum in America and for the rest of the world, up and down a continent, people getting to vote and speak. So that's 225 years ago. And then 150 years ago, ending slavery, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued 150 years ago, as of late September, actually. So just this week, last week, was the 150th anniversary. And that's epic, getting rid of slavery, putting us on a path. But then woman suffrage, the doubling of the franchise, that's this sort of, again, epically democratic thing. It's a largely Western idea. Woman suffrage comes to America from the West. Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Idaho first. California does it early on. And it causes us, in a way, and not all of it is written. The Constitution doesn't say in so many words that women have to be allowed to vote equally on juries and serve equally on juries, but of course they do. It doesn't say in so many words that women have to be equally eligible to serve as legislators, but of course that's unwritten and implicit. It doesn't say in so many words that a woman gets to run for president, and the original Constitution, in referring to president, says he, him, his. But of course the 19th Amendment means that Sarah Palin has a right to run for president, and Michelle Bachmann and Geraldine Ferraro and so on. It's unwritten, but of course it follows from the 19th Amendment, and other things follow too. The presidential election that we are now seeing, actually, there are two running mates, really, that Barack Obama has. He has Joe Biden, but he also has Michelle Obama, and she could succeed him. She's a Harvard Law School graduate, in a way that Martha Washington could never have succeeded George Washington. Abigail Adams could never have succeeded John Adams. In today's world, you have very different first ladies, thanks to the 19th Amendment. Franklin and Eleanor, Bill and Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, could also run next time around, Barack and Michelle Obama. These are profound, even if unwritten, implications of the 19th Amendment revolution. The 19th Amendment is, if Barack Obama wins, it's going to be because of the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm. He's not probably going to win among the men, but he will win decisively among the women. So if he wins, it's because of the 19th Amendment. Obamacare was ratified by the Supreme Court by a narrow 5-4 vote, in which the men voted against it on the court, 4-2, but all three of the women on the court, put it over the top, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That's because of the 19th Amendment. And I called it Obamacare, but I could have called it, and I probably should, since I'm talking to a Northern Californian, Pelosi Care, because, the first woman Speaker of the House from Northern California, she's an important factor in the adoption of this thing. These are 19th Amendment phenomena. Our society is more inclined toward a safety net, welfare state, if you will, because women have tended to vote for that, more than men. The 19th Amendment has radical, if unwritten, implications and reverberations for our system.
The other things that you talk about that have had a profound effect are things outside of the Constitution, what you call the symbolic Constitution.
Yes.
Talk about those things.
So if we were just to poll your readers, and I just said to them, listen, the Constitution is partly what holds us together. It's our Queen Elizabeth, our Taj Mahal. It's what kind of we have in common as Americans. And even if we don't all read it, we have a certain reverence for it. And if I said, but are there other texts like that that also really are set out an American creed, what it means to be an American? I've played this a little parlor game around the country, and whenever I ask the audience, name some other texts beyond the written Constitution that are like that in defining what it means to be Americans, I always get, wherever I go, the same nominations. People say the Declaration of Independence, the Gettysburg Address, Emancipation Proclamation, the Federalist Papers, the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the I Have a Dream speech. There are others, but what's interesting is how quickly, you know, 30 seconds, there's almost general agreement that the ones that I just mentioned are at the top of the list. We have, as Americans, a set of other texts, like the Gettysburg Address, like the Federalist Papers, like the I Have a Dream speech, that sort of define what we Americans believe in today.
One of the other impacts that have been powerful, particularly as government has gotten larger, is what you refer to as the institutional Constitution, the system by which all of this works.
Yes. And in Britain, they don't have a written constitution. They're a little offended if we say they don't have a constitution, because they think, you know, every society has a constitution. It's just the way the society is organized and the system is organized. But they don't have one single written text that purports to set forth the basic governing principles. We do have a text, but my claim is we also have, in addition to the text, a kind of set of practices, institutions, and understandings that have grown up in interaction with the text. That's out. So Britain doesn't have an American-style written constitution, but to some extent, we Americans do have a British-style institutional system that has grown up, and in the same way that I tried to suggest earlier, that the judicial cases now pretty much line up with the text of the Constitution, I try to show that our general institutional practices, how the House of Representatives is organized, and the Senate, and the presidency, and the cabinet positions, and the administrative agencies and independent agencies, the judiciary itself, how all of these branches of government actually are set up in ways that pretty closely correspond with the written Constitution, but sometimes the written Constitution is ambiguous, unclear, and what basically completes the Constitution, glosses it, clarifies it, are the institutional practices that in effect implement. So, for example, the Constitution doesn't, in so many words, say that Daryl Issa, pick another Californian, can hold a congressional hearing and subpoena witnesses and hold people in contempt if they don't show up. You will not find the contempt power in the Constitution. You will not find the congressional oversight power in the specific words of the Constitution. But our practices for 200 years have always allowed that, and so these practices actually, and there are certain things in the written Constitution you can read to support these traditions, and I'm saying we should read them that way so that our institutional practices that go all the way back in many cases to George Washington's administration fit with the written text. I'll give you a couple of other examples just from the headlines of this week. If Barack Obama at a certain point decides he's going to recognize the Syrian rebels as the proper government of Syria or something, where does the Constitution give him that explicit power? Well, not in so many words. But Jimmy Carter was allowed to recognize the People's Republic of China as the official government, and Barack Obama recognized the Libyan rebels at a certain point, and that's because way back when George Washington early on recognized the French revolutionaries as the new government of France after King Louis had toppled. So it's not so much the text is absolutely clear that this is the president's call and his alone. The text is ambiguous on this. But our institutional practices, our unwritten constitution, going all the way back to Washington, make that clear.
And then finally is what you talk about, the unfinished constitution, the way in which our society is constantly evolving, things are constantly changing as they are with technology, for example, and so many other things, and how we go about addressing those issues, and this notion that you talk about that really time is our best friend.
Yes. You and I, we've been talking a lot about the past, about what happened 225 years ago with the Constitution being put to a vote, what happened 150 years ago, a civil war, the Emancipation Proclamation ending of slavery, what happened 100 years ago with women getting the vote. If you and I can talk and our fellow Americans really passionately and seriously about stuff that happened a long time ago, my claim, and this is a Burke-like idea also, is that we have to be thinking about the future, about about posterity, thinking 100 years from now, 150 years from now, 225 years from now. There is an unwritten obligation of each generation that ties it to the past and connects it to the future. So the last chapter, America's unfinished constitution, tries to imagine what additional amendments we might add to the constitution now or shortly in the future that would be the sensible next chapter to a sort of an ongoing story. What's extraordinary is how all the amendments thus far have generally, prohibition excepted, expanded liberty and equality. So what amendments would sort of fit that story? I'll give you one because it's a California example. Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't eligible to even run for president because he was a naturalized American citizen. Well, it's possible to imagine that in the future the Constitution would be amended to allow people like Schwarzenegger or Jennifer Granholm, who now lives in Berkeley, former governor of Michigan, who was born in Canada. It's possible to imagine that the Constitution might be amended in the future to let people who have come to the United States a long time ago, who have to take a test to become a citizen, who have really shown their patriotism through a long career of public service, to make them eligible for president. That's one possible amendment that I could actually imagine happening because states do it. States let Native Americans, naturalized citizens, become governor. And because it fits this story that we've been talking about of increasing inclusion and equality in our system. And also because actually both Democrats and Republicans might buy it because it could be of interest to both parties to show as part of a reasonable immigration reform package that illegal immigration is one thing, but legal immigration of people who come to the United States and make contributions, that's a different thing that both parties believe in.
The idea also that time eliminates self-interest.
Oh, yes. So one thought is, well, you know, you're just saying that because you're in the tank for Granholm or because you like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something. You could imagine some amendments saying, you know, it shouldn't be about what's in our immediate self-interest. So we're going to propose some rules, and they don't even go into effect for 20 years, for 30 years, for 40 years. This would be a ridiculous way to hold an ordinary election. Okay, we're going to vote between Romney and Obama, and the winner takes office in 30 years. No, that would be silly, and that would be silly for ordinary laws. Oh, well, we're going to vote on a law today, but it doesn't take effect for 30 years. But when we're talking about a constitution, about a kind of law that exists for a very long period of time, yes, one idea might be we should try to figure out today what would be fair rules for our grandchildren yet unborn. And we don't know whether they'll be rich or poor or gay or straight or male or female. And so in thinking about what would be fair rules for our grandchildren yet unborn, our own individual self-interest to some extent falls out of the picture, and we instead try to think just about what's actually fair and just for our posterity, for the future.
In many ways, that's the conversation we're having, both political parties are having, with respect to Social Security, that it doesn't affect people for X amount of years, but it's something that's way down the road.
And Social Security is precisely for that reason a kind of constitutional a system that we have in place. It's an intergenerational compact, just like the Constitution itself is this intergenerational thing. It's pretty deeply entrenched. Social Security, like it or not, is hard to get rid of, almost as hard as getting rid of any provision of the constitutional text. It's a pretty entrenched part of our system, and we're in it for the long term, and we have to think about it in long-term ways.
Akhil Amar, his book is America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. Akhil, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. Love to do it again if you ever want.
Appreciate it.